Hello, welcome to the Intellectual Agrarian Podcast. I'm your host, Terrence Lehue. On this show, we talk about philosophy from the farm, learning from the stories and skills, ideas, and insights of farmers and agrarians from around the world. Our guest today is Daniel Firth Griffith from Timshill Wildland and author of both Boon and Unfinished Portrait in his most recent book, Wild Like Flowers, The Restoration of Relationship Through Regeneration. Together, we have a fantastic conversation about his origins in agriculture, what it means to rewild, his book, Wild Like Flowers, and much, much more. This is truly an amazing conversation. We even get some behind the scenes, or rather behind the pages, insights into what went into Wild Like Flowers. So please join us today for a conversation with Daniel Firth Griffith. Daniel Griffith, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks, Terrence. It's just a blessing to be here and be with you. I'm a very big fan of the podcast. Thank you for all you do.
Hey, I really appreciate that. It's always fun to get to have someone on the show that when you start looking up their information, you're like, oh dear goodness, why haven't I interviewed this person earlier? So I'm really glad that we had this opportunity today. And in your bio, one of the things that just immediately strikes me is the words background in technology and entrepreneurship. I don't usually see those as things that precede current farming. So I have to ask, how did we go from technology as a focus to now you're in agriculture?
Yes, right, Terrence, that's the question. You know, our regenerative journeys are so unique and different, and at the same time, they really share a lot of the same characteristics. You know, when I first got into farming, I think it really was a weird thing, a unique thing for someone who didn't come out of a family farm to be in the space. And I think it's a growing reality today. I think there's a lot of new farmers, be them organic veggie farmers or regenerative animal based farmers, coming on today. And it's exciting to see. And I'm just thrilled to be a part of it. But into that story of how I went from technology and entrepreneurship to agriculture and the regenerative movement in particular, it begins, you know, I grew up in a homeschooled family of six
with awesome.
A father who was and still is today a serial entrepreneur. Both of my parents were just colossal parts of our lives. You know, we grew up on 30 acres just outside of Cleveland, Ohio. It had meadows and
did you guys do any kind of farming
even
on the 30
today
acres?
I would consider silvo pastures. We didn't. No, we didn't do any sort of farming. I mean, we had a small little garden that we always tinkered with, and we always had, you know, 1 to 10 laying chickens. That really was my mom's passion project, you know, just in like a barn coop. But there was never a focus. It was more or less we just had the space and we wanted eggs and some, you know, seasonal veggies. And so in that way, it really was just a 30-acre playground. Like I said, meadows, streams, woods. There was a huge 3-acre lake that we fished in all the time. But you know, I say those things to make this note. Our daily schooling routine, being homeschooled, was what my mom considered outside playtime. It was, I tell folks, like recess on steroids, and more like the movie The Revenant than like swings and tags and laughter and slides and stuff. My brother and I would just run around more or less buck naked outside, just clothed in dirt and soil of our place. And in many ways, it was a wild childhood that we had just on the periphery of, you know, a huge city of Cleveland, Ohio. But, in many ways, it was a really great balance, right? We had order in the sense that our father was a serial entrepreneur and very hardworking individual. We had schooling and academics. I mean, my brother today is a PhD and professor at King's College, New York City. My sister's a nurse.
Oh, wow.
My other sister, my youngest sister, is probably smarter than everybody else. And I graduated, you know, college with pretty good, you know, degrees and grades and such. So, you know, we learned, you know, but we also had great freedom and wildness. And my soul, I could definitely say, has been singed and touched by that wildness.
Well, and I just want to add a comment there, if I can.
Here,
if I can throw in a comment.
Absolutely.
There, I think that's fascinating to see how you had the order in one stage, but then you also had the ability to experience the wild. And I would argue, because I was homeschooled, I would argue that that level of
awesome.
Extremes to a degree, and that having the, okay, I'm self-disciplined to a degree, because I think that obviously it varies depending on the family, but more often than not in a homeschool family, I tend to see that the students are usually in some degree self-disciplined to do their work. And yet on the other hand, then you have that open opportunity literally to go and wander and do and experience. And I think that that's the thing that makes homeschooling, in my opinion, so interesting and fascinating, is because you have those two ends of the dynamic. And by bouncing off between those two ends, you really get to experience life.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think I'm a big fan of homeschooling. It's what we're doing with our kids, and we're very happy. You know, and one of the key foundational, you know, positive forms of abundance that I think homeschooling and homeschool children really have is that ability to, from a very early age, have not just self-discipline, but like self-mastery, right? It's really put on you to become who you want to become. You're not moving through a system. You know, your peers are either older than you or younger than you because they're your siblings. And unless you have a twin, that's just mathematically the case. And so you're either pushed to pull people up, right? Your younger siblings, or you're being pulled to grow up yourself by your older siblings. And it's a really great balance, you know, between wildness and the cultivation of, I would say, civilization and, you know, Western thoughts and academics and, you know, and that side of the life. And so, you know, in that view, that's exactly how we grew up. That said, unlike the rest of my siblings, you know, I really did truly from a young age favor the wild side of life. I remember, you know, my brother and I used to spend our summers down in Southern Ohio at a family friend's about 100 acre farm. You know, some kids of our generation look forward to new toys or video games or what have you. You know, I used to look forward to the summer to spend time down in my heaven, which was this seemingly wild environment of rural Southern Ohio, nestled into, you know, the introductory hills of the Appalachia Mountains. And it truly was my heaven. And there's a joke that we still have today, this family, in our family, how, I mean, whether or not I was 5 or 7 or 10 or, you know, 15, I would cry all the way home when we would leave. Like, I was so connected. My soul was so intertwined and woven into the fabric that was this great open space where Cleveland, Ohio was just a distant thought. It wasn't a close reality. I was just so married to the place that when we would leave, I would bawl myself to death. Like all the way home, three and a half hour drive home. My parents used to go nuts trying to get me to stop crying and calm down. You know, and it's a joke today. It was kind of a painful reality then. But the point is, you know, something always attracted me to wild places, you know, which is heavily what my new book is about, which we'll get into. But before we do, answering your question still, I'm trying to get there. It's confusing to most folks. I'll say that my story and my journey into regenerative movement, because, you know, although I was always attracted to wild places, and although, you know, my childhood photo albums have more pictures of me, you know, buck naked or almost naked, covered in soil and dirt, I was also at the same time a very athletic individual. You know, okay. I played sports, you know, all throughout my life. You know, and I always had dreams of playing in college. My dad was a college football player. I always looked up to him, and I always wanted to do the exact same thing. I wanted to play college football at a very high level. And you know, all through middle school and high school, you know, we won national championships and state titles and wrestling. And my junior year in high school, I was a top ranked defensive player and had many Division I scholarships to play football as a middle linebacker. You know, today I look back and my teammates in the wrestling field went on to win, you know, NCAA national championships, and some went to the Olympics. I had football teammates that are, you know, Super Bowl champions in the NFL. Oh, wow. You know, that was the caliber in which I played, and I was very good at it. You know, I loved every second of it. I would get up at 5 a.m., work out for an hour, you know. In high school, I went to high school because at the time there was no homeschool involvement in competitive or organized sports. you know, I would get up, work out for an hour or two, go to school, work out for another hour, go to football practice, then, you know, travel 30 minutes down the road and work on footwork and speed techniques for another hour, come home, do homework, go to bed, you know, repeat that, you know, 5 or 6 days a week. It was a pleasure of mine. It was all, you know, on my back. I love the thing. My dad just wanted to support whatever I wanted to do, and this is what I wanted to do, and he supported it fully. That said, this is a story, and I'm trying not to get bogged down too much into the details because there's a lot of them. My senior year in college, my senior year in high school, everything changed. I was diagnosed with a couple, one, two, or three different severe genetic diseases, and complications ensued and terminated my life as I knew it. I had worked to this moment to be one of the top, you know, college football recruits on the East Coast of the United States. And it just left literally on Monday. It was there on Tuesday. You know, I was struggling just to make it. And so it was a hard shift. And again, you know, I'm skipping over some details here for the sake of time, but you know, on Monday I had scholarships, and on Tuesday I was literally getting phone calls, you know, from D1 football coaches that, you know, most people would recognize the names of, just saying, hey, listen, you know, it's over, you know, don't worry about it. We'll just move on. And, you know, a severe depression followed, and years upon years of trying to get back on my feet, Eastern, Western medicines combined, you know, from acupuncture to really intensive, you know, serious surgeries at the Cleveland Clinic and similar like hospitals followed. With no real hope in sight. And I'm skipping over some details, but the point is there was hope. I just couldn't see it yet. Mm-hmm. And years later, I was actually a junior in high school or in college at the time. So you can see it truly was a couple years of struggling. I was married to my wife, Morgan, at the time. You know, I still am, but we were married at that point in time, and I was sitting on the back porch reading a book. And in many ways, from a physical perspective, I really became a vegetable. I had no energy. I really was a couch potato, maybe is another way of saying it. But I had mental energy, which was really good. I devoured books, you know, even more so than I do today. And I read still too much today. I just started devouring books, and my wife was working, and we were living at my family's house, my childhood home, with my parents, just because we needed the help. As a side note, to give just a little bit of details, because I think they're needed. My junior year in college, I weighed just as much as I weighed or I wrestled in sixth grade. And I cut weight in sixth grade to wrestle at that weight. And so I was even smaller than I was in sixth grade. That's how much my body had deteriorated and just in the
especially going from playing really football to...
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Go, you know, turn on the TV, look at Division I, you know, college linebackers, and then look at a sixth grade skinny kid. Right. And that's what I went from, you know, and what I landed to. And so that really is an accurate representation of my senior year to high school to junior year in college health journey. But the great thing is regeneration, right? It is cyclic, and death begets life. And that spring, that was ending my junior year and going into my senior year in college. And like I said, I was reading a book on my back patio. My wife was working full time, and I had made a fire for myself in this little chimenea spot. And my mom walked out of the back sliding glass door, and she looked at me and she smiled, but I'll never forget that. On top of her smile, there was a tear in her eye. And I'll never forget this moment. I could tell you what I was reading. I could tell you what I was wearing.
What book were you reading?
The tree. It was Joel Salatin's Folks, This Ain't Normal.
Oh, okay. Yeah, that's sitting on my shelf right now.
Yeah, a friend, actually, that the family that we used to spend summers down in Southern Ohio, they had actually given me the book. And they said, hey, listen, I think you need to take a look at this. So really, really a crazy happenstance. You know, today I see it as just, you know, intense purpose that was all around me. But at the moment, I didn't see the connection. But my mom walked out this door, and she looked at me with a smile on her face and a tear in her eye. And she said, Daniel, listen, we've traveled around the country for years. We've done every sort of procedure and test and surgery that you could possibly do to really eradicate this disease from your body and your life. And you continue to waste away. And I had gone to college and came back home and gone to another college and then came back home. And I kept trying to live life, and life kept trying, or really kept successfully evading me, if I could say it that way. And she said, but Daniel, there's one thing we haven't tried. And she said, we haven't tried chickens. And it was silent, right? And today I kind of giggle about it. And she says, Daniel, the only thing we haven't tried is turning our health and your health journey from passive, meaning seeking help, to active, meaning going and grabbing the thing itself yourself. And, you know, like I said earlier, we always had a couple chickens, you know, in our lives growing up, but we had never, you know, thought about raising chickens for like meat and food and, you know, as a staple in our diet and being self-sufficient and really participating in our food system. And we knew very little about it. You know, the only book I'd ever read on agriculture, let alone local farming or sustainable agriculture or regenerative agriculture, was the book that was currently in my hand, Joel Salatin's Folks, This Ain't Normal. And that day, because of my mom's thoughts and vision, we bought 100 black Australorp chickens from Murray Hatchery. They arrived, I think, 2 weeks later. And I can tell you now, many, many years later, my wife and I farm, you know, 400 acres here in Central Virginia. And you know, I'm talking to you. And it really was the first step in a very large journey, or long journey is perhaps a better word for it. But that was our introduction into farming. Now, that's not totally your question. That was a backstory. And what I would like to note here is all throughout my life, my dad owned many different companies. Interspersed throughout this narrative was me working for a good majority of them. As you know, when you are homeschooled, you have a lot of free time to really investigate more of the older style of learning and education, which is book learning mixed with apprenticeships and things like that. And I always had apprenticeships growing up in my dad's different organizations and companies and businesses. But I always gravitated to his software development and digital, you know, engagement type agency. And by the time I was 11, I was actually working part-time. I learned code and mathematics, computer science, information systems just started to come naturally to me. By the time I was 17, I was actually working like 20, 25, 30 hours a week for the company. And by the time my junior year in college, actually right before the whole chicken thing, I had more or less taken the company over just in terms of, hey, I've been here for so long and I know what I'm doing. And it was becoming a multi-generational family business at that point. And I thought when I was graduating, I mean, I went to college for computer science and mathematics. I thought when I would graduate, I would find some sort of tech job and then migrate back into the family business to take it over. And it's funny, just like a couple years ago, I was winning coding competitions at Carnegie Mellon. And now I'm in the middle of nowhere, rural Central Virginia, you know, looking at cows and shoveling manure. So that's our journey into regenerative agriculture. It's one of pain, but one of great hope by really seeing health as active, something we participate with and not entirely or only passive, something that we can seek. So I hope that answers your question. It was a little bit elongated, but
that's fine because you made a couple of points that I'd love to address. First and foremost, black Australorps are, I think, my favorite breed of poultry, to be honest. I grew up on an organic grass-fed cattle farm and we had black Australorps and they were my favorite, I think mainly because they were the most docile breed ever. Like you just walked near them and they just kind of cringe in that chicken position where they're like, okay, we're someone bigger than us is around. It made it so much easier to collect eggs. But then the other thing is, I'm not certain if you've ever read this book, but just based on some of the stuff that we mentioned just with learning and apprenticeship, have you ever read Robert Greene's Mastery?
I haven't. No, I'm going to write that down though. Greene's Mastery.
I highly think that you'd enjoy it. It's a great book, especially when we're discussing apprenticeship models and how, realistically speaking, it is that engagement, because you can even draw the perspective of passive versus active into so much of not only just our health and how we react to the world, but even in our professions. Because think about it, most of us these days are just going to college, getting our degrees and expecting, oh, we're going to get our job, instead of engaging with what are the opportunities that could be out there and trying to learn what those are.
Yeah, that's exactly right. That's exactly right. I think when you do make that shift, I mean, in my health journey, you see it with, health returning. Like I said today, you know, I own and manage a 400-acre farm that's 2 miles long and and I have, you know, the perfect health to make it happen. And so there's a successful case study in the health side. But in the professional side, which is, you know, interrelated and connected, but still separate, you know, I today am the acting president of that software development company. I don't spend that much time in the space, but, you know, as the president and you know, the creative director, I still have a lot of hands in the pot. But, you know, I'm 27 years old. It's a multinational award-winning digital engagement agency that serves John Deere and Sherwin-Williams and a bunch of other, you know, very significantly large organizations. And it shows, I mean, I had opportunity. It's a family business that I worked in since I was basically seven, but really since I was 11. And so that is, you know, part of the story, but it shows you when you dedicate your whole soul, your body, your mind, your spirit, mm-hmm. Actively into the thing itself, what comes out of that is, you know, oftentimes it's not always abundant. Like, for instance, right, my good friend and fellow teammate wins a Super Bowl and I don't, right? It's not always in your favor, but it always ends up being abundant in your life. Mm-hmm. You know, I think, and I think that's the key takeaway. So, you know, I'm happy for the journey, and it's a blessing that it's my journey.
Let's get a little context here. Tim Scholl Wildland, 400 acres. What do you guys raise? Tell me just a little bit about this incredible place. Just from what I've heard, it's definitely a place I want to visit. Let's start with that.
Well, to be clear, we do wildland tours and wildland stays, you know, most weeks during the growing season. And we have glamping sites and different rentable spaces. So you are always welcome. Always welcome here. So Tim Scholl Wildland. Tim Scholl is owned by and run by my wife, Morgan, and I on a family farm here in Central Virginia. Tim Scholl is a 400-acre process-led regenerative and emergent conservation landscape that we understand the vision of is to nurture ecosystem regeneration, carbon sequestration, nourishing foods, biodiversity, and wild and domesticated species habitat for all of what we understand our community to be, wild, farmed, neighbors, and the like. One of the fundamental tenets, before I get into what we do, it's important to understand why we do it. Mm-hmm. You know, we're very firm on that. And we believe, my wife and I and my family, we believe that we managers, holistic managers, farmers, are the co-pilots in the vehicle of resilient regeneration. And what we do, our role is to help direct the drivers of ecosystem function, the drivers that have their, you know, quote unquote, hooves on the gas pedal and the steering wheel. You know, from cattle to carrots to crown beard, it's a native weed here that's severely invasive, and it's a good part of the book that I wrote. But we are the co-pilots, the actual drivers of ecosystem function, that the true regenerators of our ecosystems are our animals and the systems that, you know, we direct them into, you know, as the co-pilots. But anyways, geological context, the Central Virginia Piedmont ecoregion. You know, I bring that up to say that we really farm and work in the microclimate sandwich, right, between the Appalachian Mountains and the sandy beaches of the Atlantic, between elevation and the coastal plains. And so it's a really special place to be, and it's just a blessing to be here. But anyways, Tim Scholl is focused on, and again, I'll focus on the word wildland. We don't call ourselves a farm. That was an intentional decision when it came down to branding the vision or the context that we feel very comfortable with. But Tim Scholl Wildland is focused on butterflies, in as much as we're focused on cattle and hang weights. Perhaps we always make the claim that it is because we focus on butterflies that our hang weights are exceptional, which again is more of a lead into the book that I'll postpone for now. But anyway, so we raise grass-fed and finished cattle and sheep next to, you know, a decently large group of heritage and holistically foraged hogs or pigs. We also have, you know, a couple acres under perennial gardens, food forest, berry guilds, and the like, and manage about 200 acres of regenerative woodlands for wildlife habitat and timber production. Our context, our holistic context, is the empowerment of natural process, not the recreation or the manufacturing of abundance via mimicking natural process. Mm-hmm. I think either way you go is perfectly fine. Make sure that I want to make sure that I make that abundantly clear. You know, yeah. Joel Salatin is a good friend of mine. His vision is biomimicry, right? Which mm-hmm. is the, yep. the mimicking of natural systems to create abundance. Our context is different because our land base, our visions are different. How we want our lives to be is different than Joel's, and that is a very beautiful thing. We call that uniform diversity, right? We're all pushing towards regeneration, and therefore it is uniform, but it's diverse in the sense that we all have different pathways to get there. So Joel is pushing for biomimicry, right? Creating natural abundance by recreating natural systems. But our focus is to actually create the natural system. That's what really turns us on. That's what gets us out of bed. And so a lot of our lives, you know, outside of just moving cattle in the standard regenerative type practices, it's sitting there and counting butterflies. I mean, we spend more of our time in the summer, you know, counting the different emerging species of pasture plants, forbs, shrubs, rushes, sedges, trees, whatever they are, and counting butterflies than we do moving cattle or, you know, handling cattle or pigs or sheep or the occasional chicken. And so, that, I mean, that's a bird's eye view of Tim Schull.
Or a butterfly's eye view of Tim Schull.
Yeah, butterfly's eye view. I like that. I'm writing that down. That's a good way of saying it. That's right.
Well, and I don't want to spend too much time camping on this topic until I can camp at your place, but you talk about the Robina Institute on your website, and I just really want to touch on that real quick before we start talking about what it means to be wild and your new book, Wild Like Flowers. So what is the Robina Institute, and how is that different than Tim Schull?
Yeah, that's a great question. I'm actually thrilled you asked so we can put a voice to this thing, because a lot of people do ask us. The Robina Institute is deeply connected to the visions and operations of Tim Schull Wildland. Absolutely, that's true. However, Robinia is not a farm, but an institute dedicated to advocating, demonstrating, and educating the supreme abundance of holistically managed and well-designed living systems. You know, said in a different way, and maybe this is more clear to some of your listeners, we're a regional hub. Robinia is a regional hub of the Savory Institute, and we work closely with Alan, you know, Savory and his team worldwide to regenerate the world's grasslands and also the communities that depend upon them. So whereas Tim Schull Wildland is, you know, quote unquote, a farm, right? We're producing, you know, soil and meat for our local community. Robinia is teaching others and consulting others on how to do that, you know, for themselves. So we teach on-site and online courses and consult, you know, all over the country for farm design and farm transition projects. It might be interesting to note here, you know, as we progress towards a discussion of the book, that we're currently piloting, a large-scale land transition project that marries regenerative finance with holistic marketing and market distribution services to kickstart the transition of family farms or even commercial farms to a at-scale regenerative farm. That pilot project is called the Commonwealth Network, which at a high level brings financial capitals, you know, to farmers for design and infrastructure and educational purposes alongside living capital, where we literally will give farmers as a 100% a donation, and we'll give these farmers, you know, cattle with, you know, exceptional grass genetics, you know, livestock to alleviate the initial burdens of transitioning over to a grass-based system. And then we bring in Savory's EOV, Ecologic Outcome Verification Program, into their farm's landscape, which then opens up USDA processing and national food distribution to buyers like Epic Provisions and Patagonia Provisions and Timberland and a bunch of other companies like that. Anyways, the point is Commonwealth Network is a full nose-to-tail sort of approach where we're seeking to empower different regenerative farmers, either farmers that are currently commercial and trying to transition or regenerative farmers that are just struggling to scale, right? They might have 400 acres, 500 acres, or even 100 acres of land that they pay a mortgage on, but due to a lack of finance or due to a lack of good cattle genetics or due to a lack of market access, which is why we say no is hail, because all three of those things really matter. Yeah, and this is a serious thing. They're just struggling to get over that hurdle. And so we come in and we provide the finance, we provide the living capital, which we're calling the cattle and the livestock, right? The great grass genetics. And then through the Savory Land and Market and EOV system, we bring market and distribution to them so that they get paid an incredible you know, sum of money to live and to thrive and to raise a family in an abundant environment while farming, right? Which today it at times feels like an oxymoron. So that's the work of Verbinia. As you can see, it's very similar to Tim Schul, but at the same time, it's entirely, you know, different in many ways.
It's like so the farming is the active, it is the specific is the action that you're doing, and Verbinia is the description almost to a degree. It is the engagement for other people to kind of look in and see what you're doing and also translate what you're doing to share to other people.
Absolutely. Yeah,
and
that's
I have
exactly
to say,
right.
The Commonwealth Network here, we're going to have to do another episode at some point just to dig into more of that. Just put it on your calendar. We have to have that conversation at some point. So one of the things you specify in talking about your farm and you discuss, bring up a lot in Wildlife Flowers, has come up a lot in our conversation today, the idea of what wildness is. So I'm just curious, like, first of all, how would you define what wildness is to the best that you can? Because it's wild, I'm sure there's a degree that we can't constrain a definition, but to the best that we can. Then the other question would be, when we're talking about rewilding land, why would someone want to rewild what has been domesticated to a degree?
Yeah, that's a great question. So we, Morgan and I, you know, as owners and operators of a farm, we entered into what we would call rewilding based agriculture before we really knew that it was a thing and before we knew it had a definition. As an author, as an advocate, as a speaker, an educator, I've tried to come up with my own definition of what rewilding is, or really what wildness is. It's easier to start with rewilding and progress into wildness. So that's the way I'm going to approach this question. But I struggle to come up with one better than what Isabella Tree, she's an author and farmer in her own right, from I forget her county, but she's from the UK.
Okay.
And she wrote a book called Wilding. That's the title of the book. It's a brilliant book. I encourage you, if this conversation stimulates any sort of interest, I mean, buy my book, Wildlife Flowers, maybe, but her book is also really, really good. It's called Wilding, Isabella Tree. But the subtitle of her book, in my opinion, is the best definition of what rewilding is. And it's the subtitle, and it's the return of nature to our farm. And so the way we define rewilding is really seeing nature as having a place in any landscape. It's the return of nature to a farm. And it sounds interesting, right? In many ways, it's a grabber, meaning like, well, I thought nature was on a farm. Mm-hmm. You know, what's the difference between nature and a farm, right? There's a lot of interesting conversations there. And the way I like to attack this and answer the question is, you know, come to an organic or regenerative farm today and go through one day in the life of that farmer. And if I were to ask you at the end of that day, what are some feelings you have? You know, you might say it was a nice day. You might say it was a romantic day. You might say, man, I got dirty all day long. You might say that it was a hard day. Mm-hmm. But what you're not going to say was that it was a peaceful or relaxing day. You're not going to say those words, because farm life isn't peaceful and it's not relaxing 9 days out of 10, right? There's always cattle to move and there's cattle out on the road and the pigs, you know, are farrowing in a freezing rainstorm. We actually just had that 2 days ago. One of our sows farrowed in the freezing rain and it was 24 hours of headache and pain trying to make sure that they didn't freeze to death. Mm-hmm. Like that's farming, right? That's what we understand farming to be. Now, at the same time, drop that, put it to the side and let me walk you through a different reality. I want you to put your boots on and I want you to go through a walk with me in my woods, right? I want you to walk with me through fields and wildflower meadows and in woods and silvopastures. Pastures. And I want you to pause and listen, right, to the many birds and biota. I want you to see the deer running away from us, the white tails bobbing, right, from this hillside through this valley. And I want you to look at me at the end of this day and I want you to tell me words of how you feel. What you're not going to say is what you said about the farm, and it's going to be entirely different. It was a relaxing day. It was a romantic day. It was a poetic day. It was a day that healed you, right? These are all words that you would describe the alternate reality. And what we found early on in our farming lives and careers, especially in regenerative farming, that it just doesn't make sense why these two things are separate. right? When you pull, when you peel back, and I'll just keep using Joel Salatin as an example, because I think it's a perfect example. When you peel back his initial rhetoric, right, which he has been arguing since, I believe, the 1980s, is that rotational grazing, sustainable agriculture, what has all become the regenerative agricultural movement is all based upon nature's inherent cycles. And it works because it's worked for thousands of years, right? We see this in permaculture. We see this in silvopasture designs. We see this in key line design coming out of Australia. And we see this in the rhetoric of Gabe Brown, you know, Greg Judy, Alan Savory, Joe Salatin, right? All of these pioneers of the regenerative movement are all claiming that regeneration works because it's always worked, right? And so what we decided early on, or at least stumbled across early on, was this initial or this deep drive in our souls to marry walking in nature with farming nature. And so at the end of our days, we didn't want to say that we're burnt out, we're tired, we're exhausted. You know, being tired, exhausted, that's hard work. That's commonplace. I get it. But that shouldn't be every day, right? We wanted to farm as if we were walking in the woods, right? With that same sort of romantic, poetic, really satisfying and healing sort of, you know, reality. So anyways, our rewilding in many ways is returning nature to the farm, but it really is just farming as if you are walking in the woods or taking a walk. And if you've read the book, and I know, Terrence, you have, and that was a blessing to give you an early manuscript, but the book begins in the very introduction saying, hey, put on your boots, we're going for a walk. And then we walk through the book, and at the very end, the last sentence of the book is, now take off your boots, right? The idea of the book is the idea of rewilding. Let's go for a walk, right? Instead of manufacturing abundance, let's just partner with it. Let's have a relation with the thing itself and see what sort of abundance emerges. What if agriculture was a peaceful and relaxing industry? What sort of lives, what sort of real abundance could we achieve? I think it would be pretty awesome. At least that's what we're finding, and that's what the book's all about. To define wildness, because that would... Go ahead.
I was just going to say, what I just want to reiterate for the audience here is what you're doing is instead of biomimicry, which is to just mimic what natural systems do, you're just going ahead and cutting out the mimicry, and you're just instituting natural systems that exist, which...
Yeah, that's exactly
it's like
right.
One of those things where people, it sounds so simple, and yet we don't tend to think about it, that, yeah, that can still be done. We're just, it's not something we're used to.
Right. Right. And it comes down to control. You know, there's this great author today. His name is Charles Eisenstein. He wrote a book called The More Beautiful World Our Hearts Know Is Possible. It's a great book. But in it, he talks about a number of things. But one of those things, one of the chapters is dedicated to the idea of control, right? Biomimicry in and of itself is controlling natural process to really create an abundant state, right? And I say these words positively. Again, what your context is up to you and your visions, your values, and your context, right? Your vision,
yeah.
What you see your life becoming. And so, you know, this is our way of doing it. You know, others have different ways. That's perfectly fine. But the point is, biomimicry is trying to control natural process to recreate abundance. What Charles Eisenstein writes is that, you know, the founders of Western science and physics, you know, Isaac Newton and the like, they understood that an object in motion isn't put in motion, that it's only in motion, right, blah, 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 and you have all of those Newtonian physics and rules of the universe, and you have not Eisenstein, but Einstein, and Newton coming together, and Bacon and the like. Well, anyways, you know, college science there for you. But anyways, the point is, if an object's motion is limited by the force of the object that put it in motion, right? Then the resultant of that rhetoric, that mathematical function, is that all motion is limited by force. The force that we can assert over an object is the maximum amount of abundance that object in motion can have. And so control, i.e. force, is limiting abundance. What Charles Eisenstein writes is that when you take the control out of the equation, and in a sense, when you lose control, what happens to that mathematical function, that equation? What happens to abundance? It goes from something that is limited to something that is unlimited. And so in many ways, what we're trying to do by releasing control and merely sitting in the passenger seat as co-pilots, and not the pilots, but the co-pilots. You know, that's our way of, speaking about how we lose control. And it's a focus that is pushing abundance from a state of limitation to being unlimited. And what emerges there, because it is emergence, right? You go from having abundance that you can plan and prepare for to an abundance that just emerges that is greater than the sum of its parts. 2 + 2 = 100, not 4, right? That's what happens when you lose control. And it's a state that just, you know, it turns the farmed ecosystem into a like sensory overload, abundant emergence that just like in many ways petrifies you day after day. Like you walk out into a field and, you know, the ironweed is popping up like crazy and you've never seen ironweed in your life and you didn't know it was there, but now it's there because of something that happened, some relationship, some community was formed, you know, via the drivers of ecosystem succession. In this example, we ran the sheep hard when they're right there 1 year. And ironweed came back, or sometimes it's negative. To be very clear, sometimes abundance can be highly negative. Like one time, poison hemlock came and just infiltrated part of our pasture. And after doing some research, the only thing that we could deduce was something there needed fixed, something that only poison hemlock could provide. And we rolled with it, right? We see that area of the farm as being, you know, in the process of you know,
a rehabilitation.
Well, I should say that part of the, yeah, exactly. Rehabilitation is occurring there at some sort of pace. It's not our pace, right? It would be much easier to take a brush hog, cut it all down, till it up or no till it up, or really bale graze it hard and plant some wonderful white clover or even some tall Bermuda grass, or, you know, just start throwing out taller vegetative bunch grass species, you know, or forbs, depending on your opinion and ecosystem. And you could rehabilitate it faster. Well, the issue is, I'm not entirely sure why it's growing, why it emerged, and what it's trying to do. Until I really have a better idea of that, I'm not going to touch it. I'm going to let natural process, right, bleed. And that's what we mean when I say that Tim Chul is a 400-acre process-led and emergent conservation landscape. Right, we're letting nature lead the process. You know, and it's a fundamental paradigm shift. One that we're very happy with and one that we've also cried over many times. You know, for instance, the poison hemlock is something that, you know, we still struggle with.
So I kind of distracted you from defining what wildness is. How would you then define it?
Thanks for bringing us back. I could ramble at times and I get lost. Yeah, wildness.
The title of today's episode might be a wild conversation.
I like it. When I hear wildness, I don't see it as chaotic in terms of any negative sense. In fact, I see it as the opposite.
Okay.
Wildness is place. It is home. It's where all life exists in synergistic and uniform diversity. Another way of saying it is resilience, which is something that the regenerative movement is pushing to, right? Regeneration is great. Regeneration producing resilience is best. And so resilient ecosystems are really just diversity in motion, right? It's ecosystem succession. But all of those words, synergy, succession, ecosystem, diversity, resilience, all of those words gravitate or really fall back on the foundational understanding of community and relationship, right? Of actually being native to place. When we talk about native plants, right, that's what we're talking about. When we're talking about species that are indicative in a particular pasture environment within the Piedmont ecoregion of the United States, that's what we're talking about. And this is a large part of what the book is about, but we, my wife and I, and especially myself, I don't see in a wild environment as humans that are supplementary. They're not additional. They're not kings operating, colonizing control over the process of particular functions or systems, ecosystems in this particular context. Rather, they're stewards, which I think is a much more biblical and much more rational way of seeing the thing. But stewards, by definition, if you look back into the original Greek and therefore the Latin of the word steward, it implies somebody within a system, right? We're not talking about somebody that's over a system. It's better seen as somebody within a system, taking care of the system that is theirs, that they're a part mm-hmm. of, that they're in place with. And well, so wildness is not something.
Just to throw it in there, if we look at the historical context of what meant to be a steward, you weren't, especially if we look back old enough in history, the steward sure had some degree of management, but he was still considered in many cases, especially again, dating back to the earlier times in history, he was a part of the property. He was just a part of the system that was helping maintain the system, not someone over lordship of the system as a separate entity.
Yeah, that's exactly right. That's exactly right. Yeah, and as stewards, we have particular responsibilities. And by the way, we also have particular geniuses, mm-hmm. right? So for instance, you're never going to put a pig in the co-pilot seat, right? In the passenger seat and tell that pig, hey, direct the cattle and the sheep today. I want you to do that. The pig is just incapable of doing that. Its genius mm-hmm. is not to manage. Correct. Its genius is to forage. Humans do not have the ability to forage like a pig or graze like a cow. Humans have the genius, the ability, the supreme power to be a steward, to be a director, to be a co-pilot, to be a manager, mm-hmm. right? When I use the word rewilding and wildness, I'm not saying that we don't move our cows. I'm not saying we don't have fence lines. What I am saying is that when we go to move our cows, I walk up to the herd and I look at it in the eyes and I say, hey, listen, we need to move. I need you to follow me. And then they follow me, right? We lead our cows. We don't push them. That's the difference.
Well, and I think that's a really great way of looking at it because, again, if you look to a biblical model, in Genesis, God gives man dominion, and it isn't the kind of dominion that we tend to think of in today's day and age when we think of dominion. Instead, he gives him basically that form of, listen, here's what I've created. I want you to steward it. I want you to be involved in the process of what I've made. This is what I have made you to do.
That's right. That's absolutely right. And I'll make this little side note, and this is maybe a good transition into the conversation of the book. But the foreword of the book, and I'll give you this little tidbit, the foreword of the book actually used to be a derivative of a previous title of the book. Before we solidified the title of Wild Like Flowers, it was actually titled something entirely different, which I'll mention here. Nobody really knows this besides my wife and I, and maybe
I'm so excited.
Maybe this is a conversation for another episode because I know this one's dragging on a bit. But I'm a farmer, I'm an educator. We've been through that, but I'm also an author, and I've written a previous book called Boone: An Unfinished Portrait. It's an American history book. Over both the context and general biographical history of Daniel Boone. And in that research, I stumbled across a good number of indigenous peoples and their histories, but also their languages. I'm mm-hmm. a big person on language, and really that's what the book is about, is crafting the language of wildness to be a proper steward of a wild land. That's what the book's about. But anyways, I stumbled upon a lot of indigenous languages. One of them, it is called Bode Wad Minwen. It's a dialect of Algonquin, Great Lakes region, Michigan, North Ohio, Pennsylvania, people of the Potawatomi, an indigenous group there. Still is there, I should note. But anyways, Bode Wad Minwen, it's a living language. It unlike a lot of languages like Spanish and French, it doesn't see nouns and verbs as either female or male. Mm-hmm. It rather sees all of those entities as either living or non-living. So the way you would talk mm-hmm. about an apple or a person is in a different grammatical set than you would talk about something that's not living. Say, I can't even think of one because most life is living in my opinion. In the book, because you've read it, but the longest chapter in the book is my attempt to prove that stones are living.
Yes.
Anyways, point is, in Bode Wad Minwen, in a living language that sees life, via that lens of selfhood and reciprocity and community and connection and relationship, they have a verb, the verb to be, that is only used when you're describing life. So to be an apple, to be a river, to be a stone, to be a cow, to be a carrot. That word to be is pronounced Yahweh, and I'll let the silence kind of settle there for a second. It's spelled Y-A-W-E, Yahweh. It's a language that's about 6 to 10,000 years old, depending on who you talk to. Mm-hmm. But it's a language as old as the Hebrew language.
I was going to say, it sounds oddly familiar there. Age.
Right. And in the Hebrew language, you know, when God comes down in the form of a burning bush to Moses, and Moses asks, "Who are you?" And he returns, "I am." And in many ways, that's the Hebrew word Yahweh, right? I am life, right? That's, you know, there's a lot of biblical things that I'm skipping over that I don't find important here. But the point is, life is seen as what living is seen to be. But we're not always connecting those things, right? When we look at a cow and we say to be a cow, we're saying the word Yahweh, right? We're saying the word that implies that this cow is a child of creation. And so what I wanted to do was name the book Yahweh, Y-A-W-E. And then it was determined that, you know, Bodhiwad Minwen is not my language. This is not my word. People get pretty confused with the word. It also kind of reads like something else, depending on, you know, how quickly you see the book's title. But the point is that the book Wild Like Flowers is in many ways a celebration of the children of creation, whether or not you're, you know, a human being or a stone or a cow, or there's a whole chapter about what it means to be a weed. Mm-hmm. You know, it's a child of creation. Well, so I don't know why we're really there, but you can help steer the conversation back on track.
That's perfectly
now.
Fine. So I'm actually, this is, you know what, again, this is the fun part about these conversations, because what it is it is a winding road, to use the cliche. And I think that that's valuable, especially in this context. And I actually think you brought the perfect segue here, because one of my specific questions was regarding language. You have this great line in the book that I'm going to read here. "This book is about becoming scholars, not of agronomy or farm businesses, but scholars of relationship and its gift of language." Just the quote sets such a stage for your book. It reminds me of the importance of language and its emphasis. And later in the book, you even comment on, referring with George Orwell, how the language itself is intrinsically limiting to a degree on how we can express and feel. And even at that, there's so much room and space in language. I mean, reading your book, you can tell that you have a love and a passion for words, as you are just using these incredible descriptions of what it means to be. And so I specifically have two kind of questions here regarding words. So first, the first one's just regarding relationships. How do you view the relationship of agriculture and nature kind of with mankind? And maybe we addressed that already with the idea of being stewards. But the second part is, what role does language play in that relationship?
Yeah, those brilliant questions. You know, to be clear, the relationship or the role that human nature and agriculture play in the last chapter, and I'm going to ruin the book for everybody here, but I answer it by saying that I really believe in what I call the hunter husbandman. That's a phrase that I felt like summed up aptly what I believe this answer to be. And that is, when we're talking about hunter-gatherer type societies, you know, let's classify them as hunters. And when we're talking about husbandmen, we're talking about highly civilized, decently Western, they are derived from Western political and philosophical thought. You're right, you have the Jefferson agrarianism and all of that. Well, anyways, the collision of these two ideas, right, the hunter husbandman, is really the solution, and is also in many ways explicative, or makes it explicit, the relationship that all three of these different tenants have with each other. And that is, a hunter is a part of an ecosystem, right? When you think at it from a, you know, think of it as, you know, from a traditional perspective, right? In order to stalk a deer and shoot it at 20 yards with a recurve bow, with all due respect to modern hunters, that takes a skill and an art and a relationship with not only the deer, but the forest or the grassland, that is really, really difficult to recreate nowadays, right? You really have to become a deer. And I'm not saying that in a cliche manner, but walk up to a deer with a recurve bow and shoot it at 20 yards, like I said, and you'll learn what I say. Well, you'll learn what I mean. Well, anyways, the husbandman in many ways is the cultivator or the nurturer of abundance, right? And I don't mean that by optimizing or maximizing the number of, you know, bushels of corn that you harvest out of the cornfield. I'm talking about a husbandman, right? In the traditional sense, in the ancient sense, a nurturer, a husband, a guardian, a steward. Where these two things collide, I believe, to be is that relationship, right? To be a steward, but also a part of the thing itself. And so that maybe that answers that question more succinctly, maybe not. But the second part of the question, you know, what does partis language play? I think language is everything. You know, if you read the book, I think the whole book is an attempt to recreate language, or maybe to have you recreate your own language in your own individual place. You know, but maybe to make this very succinct and very simple, in the book, I talk about how to move cattle. And I let down everybody who feels like it's a science, I think, because I don't. I believe it's language, right? If you want to move cattle, I want you to walk up to the lead cow. I want you to get in its face on your own. You know, I want you to get on your knees and put your face right up in its nose. And I want you to say, listen, and I want you to call the cattle by its name. In this case, in my head, I'm talking to Branya, who is our lead cow. And I want you to say, Branya, I need you to move. Will you follow me? Right? That is relationship. And that is the hunter husbandman reality of what I believe farming and regenerative agriculture should become, right? It's actually getting down in the face of your animals. And again, I don't mean this literally. Don't stick your face in a couple inches from a boor's face. That'd be bad news. But, you know, find what this means to you and just ask. Like, if you want animals to move, just ask. Don't push. Don't scream. Don't yell. Don't whip. Don't chase. Don't prod. Just ask. And the reality of this abundance is going to overpower you. What happens when you actually can form a relationship via the shared language of being? And maybe that's better said. If you want to develop a language built in relationship to foster regeneration, just be, right? Go out and spend time with your cows and lay in front of them and talk to them in a way that they want to listen. And I'm not saying out loud, you don't have to sing or write poems, or you don't have to be hippity dippity or, you know, overly philosophic. The point is, relationship is language. And the funny thing is, you know, throughout the book, I use people like Walt Whitman and Emily Dickinson and George Orwell and Shakespeare. I think Shakespeare I quote more than I quote anybody else. But all of these writers, it seemed, really understood that language outside of community, outside of relationship, is worthless. The only language worth anything is a language that is shared in common, but shared in the community of the commons. Which is why the subtitle of the book is The Restoration of Relationship Through Regeneration.
We don't need language without relationships, unless there's community, because the only reason to speak, theoretically, unless you really enjoy hearing sound of your own voice, is to share, to engage with other people and with other things.
That's right. That's right.
So I have to ask, this is my favorite question to ask writers. What was the moment of inception for your book? Like, what was the thing that, where the theme, the elements kind of came together? What was it that prompted the project and led to that beginning sentence?
Yeah, you're king of questions. I think this is another brilliant question. The creative process is something that I'm very big on. I really, really value. And I love learning about other people's creative processes because they're all different. And I'll be honest, my creative process is entirely weird. And I accept it. Let's see. So the point of inception of this book, on November 2nd, 2020, my wife and I had our third child. We named her Sequoia.
Congratulations.
Thank you. We have three kids under three, or three and under. And so it's a little bit crazy of a household, but it's a blessing, an absolute blessing. We love it to death. But our third child, a baby girl, was born November 2nd, 2020, and we named her Sequoia. And the name is spelled like the tree, like the Sequoia or Redwood tree. But really, it's a combination of the tree and what the tree is named after. The Sequoia tree was named after an indigenous chief, a Cherokee chief from Georgia. in South Carolina named Sequoia, spelled differently, but named Sequoia. And when we named her, we, you know, the first week that you get to spend with a newborn child is magical, and magical is way too small of a word for it. You know, there's a peace and a rest that, you know, may not be physical, but it's deeply spiritual and emotional. And we were just sitting there thinking, and to be very clear, and well, anyways, we were sitting there, my wife and I, thinking and talking and really just communing with life, right? Newborn life is something that you can only just commune with. That's all you really have the power to do. It's just overwhelming. And we realized that Sequoia, right? Sequoia is the natural world, right? It's a tree. But what Sequoia, the tree, is named after, like I said, is the Cherokee chief from Georgia in the 1830s and 40s. Named Sequoia, who through the Jacksonian administration and the Trail of Tears, what has been, you know, now become known as the Trail of Tears, had separated the Cherokee people for the first time in their known history. For the last, you know, 6 to 10,000 years, the Cherokee people had lived and thrived and communed and had community in the same area of the world, or at least in the same sort of tribal and you know, networks, if you will. Well, thanks to the Jacksonian administration and the Trail of Tears, the Cherokee people were for the first time separated. And this is the most intriguing part, going back to our conversation about language and the shared community of being and of communing. Sequoia, the Cherokee chief, actually for the first time in the history of the Cherokee people and their language, wrote down the Cherokee language. And for the sole being of communing, and to keep continuing the community of the Cherokees, one distance separated them. And so anyways, we named our daughter Sequoia, both after the tree and after the Cherokee chief, who actually put pen to paper of the Cherokee language for the sake of community and relationship, or continued community and relationship. And this thought occurred in my head looking at this little baby girl. And I thought, this is rewilding. This is truly what regenerative agriculture is about, right? How you get there is up to you, whether or not you castrate your steers or your bull calves into steers or not. To be clear, we don't. That's a whole other conversation that, you know, would take another hour that we can dive into. That could be another episode. But the point is, regardless how you get there, regenerative agriculture is about relationships. It's about community, but it's about the shared language of being. Right. And when the world separates us, when liberals and Republicans, right, are going back and forth, and there's great divides between how we live and why we live, and the opinions of both of those things, right, we have to establish a shared language of being in order to move the regenerative movement forward in any sort of abundant way. And so that's how the idea came. Now, I'll be honest with you, that idea is very large and very complex, and really, it was about 1% as baked as I just delivered it to you that week. But I looked at my wife and I said, hey, listen, I don't have time to write another book. Boone, An Unfinished Portrait took 5 years of my life, and it was published on October 22nd, 2022, or 2020, just, you know, 2 weeks before Sequoia was born. And now 2 weeks later, right, after that first book was published, I'm thinking about writing another book. And I knew I didn't have the time. Traveling and consulting and Commonwealth Network is just booming, and I'm spending more time off the farm than I'm spending on the farm. But I had a vision for it, you know, and I really felt called that this book needed written. And so I told my wife, I said, Morgan, I'm going to dedicate 3 weeks to writing this book. That's all I have. And I'm going to enter the creative process, and I'm going to dive so stinking deep into the thing itself that maybe something comes out of this. Maybe it's a book that's sellable, that really can actually influence and change people's lives and really move the regenerative movement forward, right? In terms of abundance, not just forward in terms of time spent. Mm-hmm. And so that's what I did. And to be honest with you, another little tidbit for you, just like the previous title was Yahweh, right? The Bodewa Minwen word for describing, you know, creation. I wrote the introduction to the book in one sitting, and today, as a published book, it is unchanged. I think two semicolons got turned into commas during the editing process, but the introduction is what I wrote. I didn't have an outline for the book. I didn't know what the book was really going to be about. I didn't know if it was a big book or a small book. I didn't really know if it was a book. I was thinking about just turning it into like an online publication of sorts, like an article. But I wrote the introduction, and it was a single outpouring of my soul in the true reality of the thing, and it's exactly what it needed to say. the introduction is unchanged. And, you know, outside of just a couple of grammatical mistakes, I'm highly dyslexic. And so I make grammatical mistakes all the time. But outside of those, you know, dyslexia induced grammatical mistakes, the introduction, you know, never changed. And I spent the next 3 weeks writing 2 hours a day. In the afternoon when the children, all three of them, were taking naps, I thank God every minute that all three of my children take naps at the same time, I wrote the book. And to be honest with you, the hardest part of writing this book wasn't the intensity of writing what has been described as, you know, one of the best books on regenerative agriculture in 3 weeks. It's during the editing process, getting my mind and soul back into the thing, into that part of that creative process. It was hard. Once I hit save at the very end and send it off to the editor, I felt like I was like hungover, or that a piece of me was gone. Something was different, and it was very hard to ever come back to that place. And so I'll even read the book today. You know, I'm recording the audiobook this week and next.
Oh, that's so cool.
To release on Audible. And I read it and I'm like, wow, I don't even remember writing this. Like, I was in such a deep creative space, that it just, what came out was emergent. And, you know, a lot of my friends and colleagues in the regenerative movement make fun of me because my two favorite words are emergent and abundance. And if there's a third word, or if there, you know, a phrase that's important to me, it's emergent abundance or abundance that is emergent. But that's really what it was. Like, I don't know what I said or why I said it, but it's, you know, I opened my soul, pasted it in a Word doc and sent it off to an editor, you know, so it was crazy.
Well, you can definitely read your soul in the book, and I highly recommend everyone should check it out. Wild Like Flowers, The Restoration of Relationship Through Regeneration. Daniel, thank you for joining us on the show today. We could continue on for hours and hours. We're definitely going to have you on the show again, because we didn't even really talk much about Boone, An Unfinished Portrait. And that is one of the things that when I was looking, I'm like, I have to ask questions. So you've got an open invitation to come back on the show. Where can people go to learn more about you, your work, and these two incredible books?
Marvelous, marvelous. Well, hey, first and foremost, it's a pleasure. I've enjoyed the conversation immensely. 2021, I have a New Year's resolution. I've never done this before, you know, to create a New Year's resolution, but I felt like this was really important. My New Year's resolution for 2021 is to just have more conversations about nothing at all, or for no reason at all, and seeing what emerges. Just to create that community, that place, you know, in a world where COVID has separated all of us, to find that community once again and find those connections and synergies and symbiosis. So this has been amazing for me, both in terms of my vision for the year and also just for my soul. And, you know, I've just loved talking with you.
Love that resolution, because firmly I believe that there are few more, for me at least, there are few more higher intellectual or engaging things that I could do. There's no greater calling to me, in my opinion, than to just sit down and have a good conversation. So I love that resolution.
There's one of my favorite books, and I'm just extending this podcast even further. So, you know, I apologize, but one of my favorite books is called The Cathedral of the Wild. I think the author name is Boyd Vardy or something like that. But in the introduction, he writes, I think it's the Zulus in Africa, an indigenous tribe in the north region of South Africa, a native people there. Their language, they have this word that says Samahanzi, which means put down all you are carrying and join my fire. Oh, and so wow. Samahanzi has been my 2021, you know, New Year's resolution. Just, hey, let's put down what we're carrying, which could be political, it could be social, it could be race oriented. And just let's sit down at the fire, enjoy a good meal and have a conversation. I believe that's where abundance is going to occur or emerge, if I'm going to use my favorite words. It's great. Learning more about us, our work and stuff. You could go to my site, danielfirthgriffith.com, and you'll learn more about me. You'll see the other two books, and there's also links all over the place to Timshel Wildland, the Rubinia Institute, the Rubinia Creative Group, all of the different organizations that we own or run. It's a good kind of landing place for folks. Wild Like Flowers is a book that'll be sold pretty much anywhere online that you buy books. Eventually, it'll be on Walmart, Target, you know, walmart.com, target.com, Barnes & Nobles, Amazon, Abe Books, and all those other retailers. It's coming out March 1st, 2021, officially. It'll start shipping on that date from all of those retailers. You can pre-order the book. Right now, it's on barnesandnoble.com as a pre-order, and it's also on our site, danielfirthgriffith.com, and just, you know, find the book for sale there. It's all over the site. You can't really miss it. I will like to note a couple things real quick. First and foremost, if you do pre-order the book, please, please, please send your receipt to book@wildlikeflowers.com, book@wildlikeflowers.com. When you do, when you basically just send the receipt, which is just proving that you pre-ordered it, and it's also letting us see your shipping address, we're going to send you a free gift of $50 value. The cover of the book is actually a commissioned plein air oil painting from the wildland, actually from the place that a lot of the book takes place in.
Oh, that's
part
so
of our
cool.
property where, you know, all these stories from the book takes place. And we want to give that to you. And so we're going to ship you a canvas print of it or whatever it is. It's an 8x10, perfect replica of the plein air oil painting. So that's your, that's our gift to you. And then we also want to give you instant digital access to one of the chapters of the book. And so if you do pre-order the book, again, on either our site or Barnes & Noble's, or if Amazon gets their stuff together, maybe it'll be up there soon before March 1st, send us the receipt and we'll send you the gift and the free chapter as our thanks. This book is all about relationship and community, and we don't want this to be purely transactional. We hope you enjoy the book, but we also want to partner with you in the enjoyment of the book, and so we want to give you these gifts. And so we're just deeply thankful. We hope you enjoy the book, and Terrence, I hope many more conversations emerge out of this one. I look forward to all of them. I hope the listener, got something out of it.
It's been amazing. And I have to tell you what, of all the things I've ever heard someone talk about for like the send in the receipt to verify your purchase type thing, that is like one of the coolest things I have ever heard. What a great idea.
Hey, it was my sister, my youngest sister, I said it was smarter than all of us in the very beginning of this episode, is actually a master portraiture artist. When she was 15, she moved away from home and moved in with the sole surviving student of Rembrandt, who, if you know anything about art or art history, he's one of the masters. And she lived with this older man and his wife until she was, I think, 20. Literally working day after day in their studio, just them three, and they would tutor her. She was apprentice, and then she was a journeyman. She went all the way through that process, and now she's a master portraiture artist and in and of herself. And so we had her out to the wildland here, and she just plein air painted this unbelievable oil canvas, painting or whatever she calls it. And we just want to make it a gift to everybody else. It's something to share. And again, that is what the book's about, right? It's about the sharing of the language of being and of community and developing a relationship where harvest is not, bushels of corn, but communion, something that we all share in terms of abundance and health and nourishment. So it's our gift to anybody who wants to pre-order it and send the receipt to us.
Daniel, thank you so much for coming on the show today. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Hey, Terrence, it's been my pleasure and blessing. Thank you so much.
Big thanks to Daniel for coming on the show today. This was truly an amazing conversation, which had me thinking long after we finished talking. His book, Wild Like Flowers, The Restoration of Relationship Through Regeneration, is available on Amazon and is currently the number one new release in soil health and sustainable agriculture and nature essays and writing. You can also find all those details in the show notes at intellectualagrarian.com/wildlikeflowers. And you can also learn more about both Wild Like Flowers and Daniel's other works by going to his website at danielfirthgriffith.com. That's also linked in the show notes. If you are new to the show, please subscribe on whatever your favorite podcast player of choice is. We're on just about all the platforms. While you are there, please consider leaving us a rating and review, especially on Apple Podcasts and iTunes. Tips on how to do this can be found at intellectualagrarian.com/review. Until next time, this has been Terrence Lehue and the Intellectual Agrarian Podcast, reminding you to keep farming the dream.
What was that? Far in the mountains.